Hi, my name is Jackie. I was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes when I was 8. I play hard because that's how I do everything. I always push myself to be the best that I can be. Type 1 diabetes does not stop me from doing the things that I like to do.
Hello and welcome to Teen 1D, the podcast for teenagers and young adults living with type 1 diabetes. The podcast is not intended as a substitute for professional medicine advice or treatment. Hello and welcome to Teen 1D, the podcast for teenagers and young adults living with type 1 diabetes. I'm Jacqueline Lynch, an 18-year-old high school senior living in Illinois. Do not consider anything that you hear on this podcast as medical advice. My guest for this episode is Liddy Huntsman. Hi, thanks so much for agreeing to be here.
Of course, thank you for having me. I've been really excited to talk to you.
So would you like to tell us a little bit about yourself?
About myself. Well, my name is Liddy Huntsman, and I am 33 years old from Salt Lake City, Utah. I've been a type 1 diabetic since I was 7, and I currently live in the Dominican Republic with my husband and 2 boys.
So the Dominican Republic, how did you end up there?
Well, I was lucky enough to marry an amazing guy who calls this place home. And so we have lived here off and on throughout the years. Previously, we were up in New York and then moved down here during COVID.
Very interesting. Very interesting. Yeah. And I will backtrack a little bit. So after you were first diagnosed, how did that change your life?
When I was first diagnosed with diabetes, I was in third grade. The fall of that third grade of that year, I'd been really sick and I got my tonsils out. And I never really recovered from that virus or whatever I was going through. And then in the spring is when I had the symptoms, but nobody in my family. I come from a very large family. I'm 1 of 7, and I have on one side of my family, I have 56 cousins. So it's a really big family. And so nobody knew the symptoms of diabetes. This was in 1997. So I felt so scared. And I did not say a word really for a day or two when I was finally diagnosed, because I thought I was going to die, because diabetes starts with die. And as a 7-year-old, you're, trying to figure out and understand what all the doctors are saying and what your family's saying, and you can't really comprehend that. And so for me, I just thought that I was just going to die. So I kind of had to like mentally prepare myself for that. And I eventually, turned to my parents on like the second day and I said, "So I'm dying. That's what this means." And of course they, were very upset with that comment and, that I had been sitting there for so many days thinking that, and obviously learned right away that type 1 diabetes it's not a death sentence and there are ways to manage it. And so that's kind of, I feel like I have the very typical story age-wise, symptom, all these things where it kind of, I was really blessed to have caught it early, not that early. I was 672. So, but not to go into DKA or any of that. I was really blessed to have it happen the way it did.
Yes. And so what systems do you use now?
So when I was diagnosed so long ago, and the ways that you treated diabetes were so different back then. I was very anti-pump until I was 25. I never wanted something on my body or something to remind me of what I was dealing with. So a pump for me was really difficult to even think of. And then at 25, I finally said, you know what? I need to get with the program and get on these new things that are helping people live better lives. And so I switched to the Omnipod and have loved it. And then I recently just took a break. I feel like I was going through like a mini burnout, just with all of the beeps. And just, I feel like in today's world, we have so much technology around us, so many beeps, so many reminders that I said, listen, if there's one thing I can't live without, it's the Dexcom, which is what I have. It's been life-saving. And then, the Omnipod that I am currently on, Traceba, taking a break. So that's kind of what I'm using currently.
Can you tell us about your involvement with the JDRF Bag of Hope? and what that is exactly?
So the Bag of Hope was created when I was diagnosed. I think it was a year or two after. The idea came to be, I had a lot of what I guess you would call today as mental health days, where I just didn't feel well. I just didn't want to go to school. I felt very alone in what I was going through. And when I was having one of these mental health days, my dad called from his office and said that a boy in his work had just been diagnosed and he was 2. And so my mom said, you know, we're going to make you feel better. We're going to go, we're going to put a bag together for this little boy. And you're going to put in everything that you wish somebody would have given to you when you were diagnosed. And I will bring a little something for the mom and we're going to go and we're going to talk. And so we ended up doing that. His name was Ryan. He was 2 years old. I think I was 10. And he was the first diabetic really I'd ever met. And walking out of the hospital with my mom, it was the first time that she had seen me smile in a long time and realized that the power of helping another person was more power. It was more helpful to me than the patient that we went and saw. And so we started making these handmade bags in Salt Lake City, Utah. And we would go up. This is before HIPAA, where you could just walk up in a hospital and visit anybody. And so we would go and we would get a list from, I believe it was JDRF at the time, or I guess JDF. We were part of the chapter in Salt Lake, but they would give us lists of people that had just been diagnosed. And so we would get the bags together. And then we would go up and we would visit all the patients that were first diagnosed with type 1. And then eventually JRF loved the idea and they kind of took over. And now today, I think it's the bag that every child and teen is given when they are diagnosed. And so it's a really powerful and important program within the type 1 diabetes community.
Have there been any reactions that have made it difference to you throughout this journey with the Bag of Hope?
I'm still involved with JDRF and I hear stories all the time. And, you know, I think it hits me most when I hear people talk about it, not realizing my involvement with it. And I think that's really, it's really been the basis of my management with diabetes, which is the emotional component. Because if you don't have the emotional component with type 1, if you cannot connect with anybody, then you cannot get through this. And as a community, that's what we need. And I think today there's been so many great groups to build that emotional part for type 1s. And so I feel like the Bag of Hope was kind of before its time. And I'm really proud of where it is today.
Yes. So I read at some point that you tried not to let people know that you had type 1. So when did this start and when did you overcome it?
So I would say I was pretty confident with type 1 when I was diagnosed in third grade. And it didn't hit me until about eighth or ninth grade, where, you know, I feel like the education around type 1 and type 2 is not that strong. And there was a comment in ninth grade where a substitute teacher was talking about, this is how you get diabetes. You know, it's when you're overweight. And there was a boy in my class who yelled in front of everyone, said, oh, now we know how Liddy got it. So that was like the first trigger where I said, oh, I'm so alone in this. And I don't want anybody to take that away from me. I don't want anyone to make judgments. I don't want people to judge me, you know, based off of that. I would say ninth grade is when it started. So I stopped really wearing it on my sleeve. Obviously never had a pump at that time. So I would, you know, sneak to the bathroom. And it really went up until I would say until 25, when I decided to get my pump is when I really said, you know what, I don't care what people say anymore. This is about my health and my future. And that's all that matters.
Yes. So where did you go to college and what was your major?
I went to the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia, and my major was sociology, specifically on cultures.
Did you find your classes to be really challenging or were they manageable?
Well, Penn is not the easiest school by any standards, so it was definitely difficult, I would say, just the classes and the workload. But on top of that, obviously, dealing with diabetes, that made it a little bit more difficult.
Do you have any advice for teenagers and young adults who are thinking about attending a college with challenging academics?
That it's okay to take a break sometimes. It's okay to not be doing everything that everyone around you is doing, right? So like for me, I had to maybe take 3 courses a semester versus 4 or 5 that other people were taking. And I was really hard on myself for that. And now looking back on it, it's okay to go at your own pace. It's okay to ask for help. And I think that in college, it's really important to be able to be in an environment where you feel safe, especially with diabetes, and, you know, be upfront with friends. And I think that there's so many communities now, though, in colleges and groups, especially with diabetes. So anyone that's looking into colleges, see if there's anything available before you go, because I think that's the most helpful thing.
What was it like moving from Salt Lake City to Philadelphia?
Moving to Salt Lake to Philly was obviously challenging in a lot of ways. It was the first time that I lived away from my parents alone, but I had grown up living around the world and traveling. And so if, in terms of culturally, it wasn't that difficult to adjust. I would say that my real anxieties started living alone with type 1. So that's kind of, that was probably the biggest challenge to deal with.
So you said that you lived alone. Did you ever have a roommate and ever have to tell them about type 1, or what was that situation like?
So I lived alone majority of my time in college, but there was a time briefly where I lived with roommates, and I had to obviously be very open with my situation. But I wish I would have been more open with them, because obviously there were a few situations where they probably should have done something. And I was too, I don't know, maybe I never talked about it the way that I should have. So for me, I wish I would have maybe been more like hands-on and been like, hey, this is what happens if I, you know, go out and if I drink, or if I do this or that, and I can't do this or that. But now with Dexcom has been the most life-changing thing. If I were in college right now, all of my closest friends and roommates would have had the Dexcom on their phone. So that's something that I really wish I would have had in college. And I think that that would have made my anxieties and stress and telling people much, much easier.
You've talked so much about the Dexcom. I too really definitely appreciate it. Do you think when more closed loop systems are on the market that you'll look into that as it combines Dexcom technology with other pump systems?
Yeah. So I obviously am really excited about the new Omnipod that just came out, or is going to come out at some point with the closed loop system. But at the end of the day, it's still the same pump and still the same beeps. But yeah, I think that when we move closer to the definition of a cure, it's definitely going to be the things like closed loop systems that help our symptoms.
Yes. So what was your next step after college?
So my next step, I graduated in 2011 and I hopped on my dad's presidential campaign which was the 2012 election. So I kind of didn't really have that period of what do you want to do or finding your first job. I just automatically went from graduation day. The next day, I think I went on the campaign trail.
What was it like being on the campaign trail?
The campaign trail, I personally really loved it because I loved going to colleges and connecting with kids that, you know, were in my same shoes and they all had the same concerns about where their country was going. So I really enjoyed meeting people that were my age, that were, you know, in South Carolina and in New Hampshire. And at the end of the day, we all had the same concerns. So that was really, I loved that part of it.
At some point, you went back to school and earned a master's degree. Can you share where you attended and what you studied with us?
Yes. So I got my master's from the New School in New York City, and it was in digital storytelling and new media. So basically what I love to do, which is storytelling.
How exactly do you use that now in your life?
In my life. So during the time of getting my master's, I attended comedy school. So I was doing stand-up comedy, improv, which is really my true love. And then I was working for Bumble, the dating app, helping grow their friend part of the app, which is called Bumble BFF. So I was basically using what I was learning in school, which is, you know, new media and digital storytelling. And I was putting that towards creating the Bumble BFF Instagram and ways that they were branding, which was incredible. It was a really great experience doing that.
Yes, that sounds really interesting. So going back, I know that you talked about living in the Dominican. Can you share with us some of the differences that you have experienced there compared to the US, whether that's just in medical care or daily life?
Well, I will be very honest and personal here. The Dominican Republic has been incredibly challenging with diabetes to the point where we're moving back to Utah in the summer because the, you know, access to insulin and, you know, there's no access to pumps or Dexcoms here. And it's incredibly hard to get it here. You have to travel to the States or rely on people. And that's been very challenging. And when I first moved here, I got involved with a couple of the type 1 diabetes organizations down here. And I was able to really learn and see how other people live with type 1. And I will say it's really heartbreaking. It's a really heartbreaking when you're an hour and 40 minutes away from the United States. There are people here. Everyone still is on NPH and regular and Humalog and all these ways of, you know, a Dexcom to them is like they can't even comprehend that, or even an insulin pump. Our housekeeper a few years ago called my husband and said, you know, my son's in a coma and he's not doing great. We don't know what's wrong with him. And I said, you know, to Eddie, my husband, I said, what are the symptoms? What's going on? Long story short, he was in DKA and he eventually passed away from it. And that is something that hurt me so much because it's so close to me, yet it's so out of my hands. And majority of the kids that do have type 1 here don't make it to the hospital in time to get care. And when they do, it's usually they're in extreme DKA. But then once you walk out of the hospital, then it's insulin and it's cost and it's, you know, the parent has to understand how to manage that child and the resources. And so it's incredibly, you know, heartbreaking here. But the one thing that I will say living here and with type 1 that really kind of put everything full circle is when I went to one of these meetings where they had these high school kids explain how they were doing and they would share their stories about being leaders in the diabetes community here. It was all in Spanish. And this is right when Spanish was really hard for me and couldn't understand what anyone was saying. It was in this little room, you know, the electricity was going in and out. And I looked over at a mom who had a little child with her. The baby was like 2 or 3 years old. And everyone there had a child that was diabetic. And I just started crying. You know, I couldn't even comprehend what I was experiencing because it was, I can't understand what anyone is saying, but I know what everyone is feeling. And that is something that unites every type 1 diabetic. I sat there and I felt what that mother was feeling. I felt what these high school kids were going through. And that to me was where I really wanted to make a bigger difference in connecting on the human level with type 1, because that's really what's going to help us at the end of the day.
To add along with that, I know along with type 1, you also have celiac. And then how did that change daily life?
Well, I also have thyroid. I guess I have the triple whammy of type 1 that we're always like praying not to get. I was diagnosed with thyroid after my first son was born. And then celiac actually was a really long journey to get there. When we had moved to the Dominican Republic in 2015, I was starting to get terrible stomach problems, like terrible. And I just assumed it was living in a foreign country and maybe it's the water or something. But I eventually ended up going to a doctor in Miami, a gastro, and he, you know, put me on different pills. Oh, maybe you have IBS, maybe you have this or that. Nothing worked. And then when I went back to see him, he was touching my stomach and it was painful on one of my sides. And he said, you know, you might have appendicitis. I really suggest going to the emergency room because you don't want to go back to the Dominican Republic with appendicitis. And so I said, okay, we'll do that. I mean, I don't think I have appendicitis, but we'll do that. So we went to the emergency room and I felt really silly being there because I felt fine. They came back. I did not have appendicitis, but I had an incidental finding of a mass on my liver that was like this big. It was as big as a bagel. And so they came back and they said, you know, you don't have appendicitis, but we found an incidental finding of mass on your tumor. And we can't tell you the prognosis of it. You're going to have to go contact your doctor and go get an MRI. And I'm like, first off, what, like, what are you even saying or what's going on? Like this. Okay. So, you know, we had to kind of process that news for a little bit. And then I ended up going to Salt Lake City, Utah, where my family was, where my grandfather started a cancer hospital and research center at the University of Utah. And I was a patient there, and it was really kind of surreal to go through that experience. I had to get surgery. They took out my mass and then they had to take out half of my liver, which your liver actually is the only organ that regenerates. So it was able to go back to normal after, which I was really grateful for. And so I said, oh, that was because of my stomach issues. It was sitting on my stomach. Okay. Makes so much sense. Get back to the DR. Stomach problems are still happening. So by then, you know, my doctor was like, hey, we need to go do an endoscopy. And then that's when they found out I had celiac. So a long process, very scary, which, you know, everything happens for a reason. And I am so glad that we found that in the process. But celiac has been probably more difficult to deal with than type 1, I will say. So it's hard because traveling and going, being on the run and all, it's been, I think, more difficult because you have to plan out everything.
Can you possibly share with us how you do manage to plan out what you do eat with celiac and just how you handle situations with it for our listeners as well?
Of course. So the thing that frustrated me when I was diagnosed with celiac was everything that I looked at was gluten-free, therefore it was healthy. So every food blogger was vegan and this, I like to eat. I like, you know, I will eat everything, but for me with celiac, everything was just so bland and not great. So I started a food blog called The Hungry Gringa. And I mean, I started it when I was in the DR the first time around and where I would just make basic, just foods that celiac people can't eat. And then I would just, you know, substitute it gluten-free. I probably should start it up again, but that was really helpful in the beginning just to like start cooking and finding ways to make normal food something I can eat. But with traveling, I pack a lot of to-go food. So a lot of to-go oatmeals or, you know, the to-go, like the Annie's, they have like the mac and cheese. But I just have gotten into a routine where I don't plan on eating at airports because the food is always gross at airports and then there's never anything gluten-free. So I always, always, always make sure to pack. That's the one thing that I probably like focus on that more than like my diabetes supplies, because that's just like my biggest pet peeve is getting somewhere and there's nothing to eat and I need to eat. So yeah, I think just planning with celiac, it's just doing the research and just overpacking with snacks, whether it's like rice cakes or, you know, things, just protein, things that you can eat, but it's difficult. And, I try to manage it the best that I can.
Yes. So you have two sons. I know that as well. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about them and if they enjoy living in the Dominican or how you have told them about type 1?
Yeah. So my first son, Harrison, he is 7, which is kind of weird to watch him in this age because it's when I was diagnosed with diabetes. And we've had a lot of conversations about type 1. And first off, they love the Dominican Republic. They're both bilingual. They are really, yeah, they're really adaptable and just, but they're wild. They're very high energy, very high energy. So, but they've loved it. And, I just got them tested for type 1 for the gene. And I'm happy to say that they both came back negative. So that was really a sigh of relief for my two kids. But with type 1, I always kind of have introduced type 1 as my first baby. So that's like for them to know and love their mom, they have to also know and love this other baby that I have. So I had a friend in Salt Lake who she was type one, and she just has not taken care of herself for years and years and years and years, kidney transplant, you name it. She's had it, you know, since I've had it. So for, you know, over 25 years. And she recently passed away from complications. And so that was something that was really difficult for me to kind of see and, you know, explain to my son, because, you know, people around me were talking about it and conversations, and, you know, I had to explain to my son, like, this is why mommy does what she does. Like, this is why she needs to take care of herself. I have to put diabetes first. You know, I have to do these things. And he has really become such a champion and understanding. Like this morning, for example, he had his first like bike race, but I was traveling the last 24 hours and I woke up, I'm been, you know, so jet lagged and tired, and my blood sugars were just, you know, I wouldn't eat, and, you know, the spikes up and down. And I had to put that first this morning. I couldn't go to his race. I had to do that. And, you know, so I think just by talking to him from day one about it, even when he couldn't understand it, he now fully grasps like what his mom goes through. So I'm an open book with my kids. My younger son Hunter is 2.5. So he's a little too young to understand. But I did have a really bad situation in California when I was just there. He took one of my syringes out of my bag, or it was somewhere, and he, I think, stabbed it into the couch. And in the meantime, like, it, you know, poked his finger. And so he was so scared. And I felt like the worst mom. Wow. But then again, he'll never do that again. But so I always try to make sure when I'm giving myself an injection or changing my Dexcom, I do it in front of them, more in like a dramatic way, so that they see it and they understand that that's not normal. You know, they don't need to do that, but their mom has to do it to be a mom. So yeah, I've been very transparent with them.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
And I know earlier that you mentioned that you went to company school, and I read that you refer to yourself as a self-proclaimed failed stand-up comedian. How did you get started in that, and where have you performed?
So I have always loved comedy. I guess I've never really understood what comedy or how people get into comedy or what makes people funny, but apparently that's been me my entire life. I just thought it was sarcasm. Very ADHD. I'm very creative. So my brain works in different ways. For me, when my dad was running for president, I was like, this is so boring. Like, this is so boring. How are people interested in this? How are people my age interested? And this is when I just graduated from college. And so then I said, you know what? How would someone make me, if I wasn't in my shoes, interested in politics? So I used that way of, you know, projecting to an audience. So started a Twitter with my sisters called the John 2012 Girls. We then started making like spoof videos of, we did one of, there was someone who was running, Herman Cain, and he had a really crazy political ad where his campaign manager was smoking a cigarette into the camera. And it was like, vote for Herman. It was like a very, you can look it up. It's a very bizarre ad. And I was looking at this and I was like, this is not normal. So my sisters and I, we redid the skit, and it was more like an SNL spoof, right? And we blew bubbles instead of smoke from a cigarette. So, but more of talking about my dad through it. And I realized that's really my love. I love being able to communicate in a humorous way to people about hard topics. Before I met my husband and started a family, I worked with Broadway Videos, who is Saturday Night Live's, their studio that they use for producing and all that. And so I was able to go work on a film for Saturday Night Live for a summer. And I said, this is it. This is really what I want to do. I love humor. I love being able to, I just love feelings. I love being able to, you know, tell somebody, and to be able to control feelings, I think, is a really strong thing. And I think comedy, if you're able to take a misery away from somebody for at least, I don't know, 10 seconds or something, like, that's a good deed. And so I started just doing stand-up in New York. I did a class down in the West Village at the Comedy Cellar. So I've performed at the Comedy Cellar a couple times. I used to perform twice a week, I think, at this place called the Comic Strip Live, which was up on the Upper East Side. Another place was Dangerfields, which was an institution. It was great. It just closed, sadly, because of COVID. And then Stand Up New York, which was another club that I loved. But I would try to make my rounds every week.
What was it like to get up in front of a crowd and perform?
You know, it's crazy. I feel my, like, I don't know. I love it. I'm a very big introvert. I don't like people. If you see me at like an event, I'm most likely I'm in the corner by my, like, I think I'm socially awkward. People don't think I am, but for me,
you certainly do not come off that way.
Well, I've had a lot of practice, but, you know, for me on stage, my favorite saying is comedy loves misery. And so it's a way for me to feel open and honest about insecurities that I have. And so comedy is basically insecurities that can meet, like, that you have, that you want other people to, you know, comedy loves misery. So it's basically been really therapeutic for me. And I have bombed so many times. I have had zero laughs a lot of the times, but, you know, there are the times when people are with you and they get you and understand and are laughing with you. It's very therapeutic. And so it's a rush and a high that I enjoy.
So how did you come up with ideas after you'd realized that this is something that you'd wanted to pursue? I know that you talked about the comedy loving misery, but were there any jumping off points that you found yourself often going to?
Yes. And it would be my background and my husband's background. I am, you know, a former Mormon from Salt Lake City, Utah. I have only been raised around a very conservative lifestyle. And my husband is Dominican and Latin. And, you know, it's a very sexualized culture here. And it's, you know, it's a very loud and it's just very different from where I'm from. And so I like to cross culture, because then they are very similar in a lot of ways. Mormons are very, you know, family oriented and have a lot of kids and cousins, and Dominicans also are the same way. So I really like to, because it's been really hard for me to adapt in both, you know, and I think in any culture, right? So that for me with comedy was me being able to feel that I'm okay, you know, adapting.
I see that you are on the leadership council as well for Beyond Type 1. How did you get involved with Beyond Type 1?
So it's a really not a normal story, I guess, for me. I was living in the Dominican Republic. Again, this was in 2014, 2015. And I was really struggling just with diet. We're always struggling with diabetes, right? And I was just, you know, on Instagram or something, and I came across Beyond Type 1, and I was like, what is this? There were all these new kind of groups that were kind of starting in the beginning, and Beyond Type 1 had this like social media app that was kind of like Facebook, but it was diabetics. I don't know if it exists anymore, but, you know, I signed up for that, and I just felt like I was connecting more and more with that. I was just needing that connection. And I was in New York one weekend with my husband, and there was a blogger named Libby, and I was following her, and she had posted, oh, Beyond Type 1, you know, meetup in New York City. And it was that weekend. And I looked at my husband and I said, we're going. And he's like, you want to go meet strangers? I'm like, yes, I want to go. We're going to go and we're going to do it. And this is going to be great. I randomly showed up. It's just so out of character for me. And I showed up, and it was a small gathering. I ended up talking to everyone. And that's kind of where I met, kind of, this is in the beginning. So some of the founders were there. And so I just was able to kind of connect and, you know, meet with them there. And then when I moved to New York is when I got more involved with them. And yeah, I think it's been an incredible tool within the community, and it's really helped me. And I know it's helped so many other people connect virtually, especially right now when people feel really alone.
To go along with helping people, I saw your 2017 article in the Salt Lake Tribune, in which you argued that CMS and Medicare should cover the Omnipod insulin pump for people who are on Medicare. How did you get involved in this issue? And is it true that Medicare now covers Omnipod?
So in 2017, I was contacted by, just because I've been in the political world and, you know, people know I'm type one. I was contacted by a friend of mine who was, the people that were fighting to get this covered were like one of his clients. And so he wrote me or called me and asked, hey, would you want to help? You know, we just don't know who to contact, or, you know, Insulet's trying to, you know, we're just trying to fight this and win to get Omnipod covered. And I said, you know, I'll see what I can do. And that's when I ended up writing an article in the Salt Lake Tribune. Just it all came down to like the wording of how pumps are used, because Omnipod is tubeless. So that's where the whole issue became a problem. I tried my hardest to find somebody who could help, you know, get this passed. I ended up getting in touch with Seema Verma, who was the head of Medicare. She was like the woman running it at the time. And I ended up getting on a phone call with her and tried to lobby and tell her my experience of why this is so important for the older generation as well with type one. And then somehow it was passed a couple of months later. So when I got that message, that was really cool to see that was able to now they're able to have coverage.
Yes, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
So as we end this episode, do you have any advice for anyone who may be listening?
Well, I have a lot of advice in a lot of areas, but specifically with type one, I think
this can be any area either. If you have a lot of advice in any area, feel free to share.
Well, you know, I think that it can go, my biggest thing with diabetes is treat it well, you know, like all we have in life are our feelings and how we feel. And if we don't feel good, if we're physically, you know, because we've decided not to take care of ourselves, like we should be able to feel good. Diabetics, like we need to feel good. Don't be hard on yourself. I think everyone's doing their best. No one knows the best way to care for diabetes. I think that's what it is. And I think that we don't think that the emotional component is the biggest thing. And to be able to find just some outlet of connection will help you through the really hard times. And I think my best quote and best advice is that no feeling is final. And, you know, you just have to get through it. Trust me, I felt terrible this morning. I felt terrible this morning, and I feel so much better now. And it's just getting through the hard parts. But we're all in this together, and I think that that's the biggest thing.
Yes. And as you were well aware, we are all more than our type one. What do you do in your free time? And do you have any books, movies, or TV shows that you would like to recommend?
Oh, well, I have a lot of things that I do on my free time. Mostly right now it's with my kids, and we're here in the Dominican Republic. I love writing. I love reading. I like a lot of documentaries. So like Sundance just happened, and it was really cool because it was all virtual. So you were able to like watch these, you know, independent documentaries in your own privacy, which is great for me. But the series I loved was Yellowstone. Very cool. And I would say, yeah, I don't know. I feel like I'm just trying to survive day to day like everyone else these days. And I think this is super cool what you're doing. And I wish so badly that like this was something when I was in high school and playing basketball. I know you play basketball. And
yes.
Yeah. And that's not easy, especially with type one. So I've been through that all. I wanted to play in college. That was like, I thought I was going to be in the WNBA, but obviously that didn't happen. So, you know, it's a day by day thing.
Yes. Thank you so much for being here today.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me. And I hope to talk to you soon.
Yes. That's all for today. If you have any suggestions for future topics or guests, or just want to say hi, don't hesitate to reach out. You can email me at teen.teen1d@gmail.com or DM me on Instagram at teen1dpodcast. If you like my podcast, don't forget to like and subscribe, as well as rate and review, as it really does help me out. Thanks so much for listening, and don't forget to tune into next week's episode. Have a great week. Bye.